Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Men's Spiritual Radio Hour with Mike Snyder and Mark Rawson here on Spiritual Connections Radio.
And I'd like to welcome you to another show, the Men's Spiritual Hour. We have a special show that we're running this evening for a guest that we wanted to get on this month. Our next show will actually be coming up Tuesday, May 26th, when we'll have one of our friends from YouTube and a pretty funny guy, J.P. Sears, will be on next Tuesday on the Men's Spiritual Hour, and that'll be on May 26th at the same time. But, you know, from time to time, we have special guests that we want to get on right away, and when we do that, me and Mike get together and we schedule a special show like we have this evening. So we're really excited to have our guest on this evening. To find out more, like if you want to see the link for any of our guests or any of the other shows on Spiritual Connections Radio, you can go to our website, which is www.spiritualconnectionsradio.com. And we're really excited as I think for me and Mike, we're going into our third year of doing this radio show. And it's just been so amazing that we've been able to have this show, which is called the Men's Spiritual Hour radio show, which is dedicated to bringing on men to talk about their spiritual journey and what they've learned in life and, you know, all the different experiences, because as you know from listening to some of our past shows, we know there's a lot of support out there for women, but there doesn't seem to be any support at all for men. Of course, I know from the feedback that we get on the show, we have a lot of women that actually listen to the show also. So we're really excited about that, and we welcome everybody. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and introduce Mike. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Oh, pretty good, Mark.
Yeah, so I'm starting to, as everybody knows, and you know, Mike, I'm new to Texas. And I came from Florida, and you would think that Florida had some tough summers. And it's actually starting to get a little bit toasty in Texas, and I was out doing some yard work today. And I'm going to be very interested to actually see what it's like by the time we hit July and August here. I'm guessing it's at least pretty nice up your way, Mike. I know we were talking during the winter that you were getting hit with some really bad storms.
We're in the 70s and 80s now, so it's been a little cooler the past couple of days, which has been nice.
All right, I'm going to let you go ahead and introduce our guests, and we'll get started.
Okay, our guest tonight for our show is James Williamson, and he's going to be talking about his book. His book's about surviving a childhood of abuse, and it's also about inner strength, the resilience of children, finding peace, accepting yourself as you are, and forgiveness. James had endured what he thought was a pretty tough and quite unusual childhood, and he also battled through his adult life. There are many things that happened to him which had to be kept secret, and in the past several years now, he's felt comfortable enough with himself that he found the courage to reveal some of these dark secrets in the form of his first book. James, it's great to have you on the show tonight. Welcome.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, it's great having you on. And as everybody knows, a lot of our guests for this year are going to be coming from Europe. And because of it, we're always happy and thankful and gratitude to you because we know it's roughly probably about 1 o'clock in the morning. So
yes, I thought I stopped enjoying these hours in my teenage years, but there we are.
So tell us, let's start with some really basic stuff so that people know where to find things. So why don't you go ahead and give out your website to everybody?
Well, first of all, the book is called They Can't Touch Him Now, and my website is jameswilliamsontaylor.com.
Hmm.
So if anybody wants to send a message... I'm just having a new website built at the moment because it's a little bit dated, so we're going to sort of spruce it up a bit. So that's under sort of construction at the moment. But I'm sure they'll have a forwarding method on the old one to send people straight through to the new one. So I think that people will be able to get in contact with me. Also, in the front of the book is my email address. So if somebody read the book and wanted to get in contact or whatever, they can do that.
Mm. So, you know, with that being said, we're going to go in and talk about all the different aspects of your life and your journey and stuff like that, but, you know, do you find that people do reach out to you and share some stories and that, you know, what is it that you do today as your day job?
My day job is fully retired.
Excellent.
I'm now retired, thankfully.
And, you know, do you get a lot of inquiries and do people share stories? And are you now becoming like a coach that helps people who have gone through similar situations?
No, not really. I mean, certainly not a coach. There have been people that have read the book that have contacted me through the website and, you know, expressed that the book was helpful to them. I always remember that I met a chap on a plane, and we were talking about the book and so on, and there was a sort of connection between us that sort of prompted the conversation that he was in the building trade and my father had been and so on, and he bought the book and he sent me an email, and it really changed the way he thought about his own past and was able to open up to his wife, who knew nothing about it. So I like to think that it has helped some people, but I'm not really a coach as such. I mean, I would listen to people. I couldn't properly advise people on how they should deal with their own situations or their own pasts, but always willing to listen or make a suggestion that perhaps they should seek counselling from a professional, but that's as far as I think I'm skilled enough to go.
Excellent. Go ahead, Mike.
So, we wanted to. Should we just have him start from the beginning, Mark, or do we want to talk about the book first?
Yeah, let's go back to his childhood on when he was in the hospital. Let's do that.
Okay. So, if you could start from the beginning for us, you know, I saw in the description that you had some complications right from birth, and I was wondering if you could explain to us what had happened at that time to begin your story.
When I was 3 months old, I developed gastroenteritis, which in those days, that was 1948, there was not much to say of antibiotics. So it was a bad time for children. The survival rate for children in those days was much less than today. And I was hospitalized, and my mother then was living in South London. She moved across the River Thames to East London and ended up living, as far as I know, with my adopted father's brother. And that is how my adopted father got and his wife got to meet my real mother, and her four children that she had with her. And then after I made a recovery, when I came out of hospital, my mother had to explain away the fifth child. And so she said to the man that she was living with, and one evening with his brother and wife, i.e. my adopted dad and mum, that I actually was her sister's baby, and her sister had cancer. To which my adopted mum said, well, is there any way we can help? Perhaps we could look after. My name then was Michael. And she said yes, and of course my mum looked after me for a week or two, and this led to her saying, given the circumstances, it might be possible that we could adopt him, because they had no children of their own. So the adoption went through, and I was signed over. So it wasn't sort of done through an adoption agency. There were no real reports done as such on my new parents, and I was sort of signed over, really, unceremoniously. And I was brought up then in the East End as James. My name was changed to James Williamson from Michael John Taylor, which is what my birth name was. I was brought up with them. My father was an illiterate scaffolder on the building trade, and my mother was a disabled shoe machinist. She'd had infantile paralysis, so she had quite a heavy limp, and one leg a fair bit smaller than the other. So my life at home was in the East End of London post-war, when there was very little for anybody. Food was still on ration, and it was a struggle. And we lived in a shared house, because lots of houses obviously had been damaged during the war. So people ended up sharing houses, and we lived in a shared house, family upstairs, we were downstairs. And we had, I think it was two bedrooms, a kitchen, what we called a scullery, and there was an outside toilet, which was shared by both families. And that's how life was. I've recently come back from America, and I saw that there's a TV program which is quite popular at the moment called Call the Midwife. I don't know if either of you gentlemen have seen that. Have you?
No, I haven't.
Okay. No, I haven't.
Well, it's quite popular, and it depicts London, or a place in London called Poplar, in the 40s, 50s, when that was my childhood, and that was the area in which I grew up. So it sort of portrays very well what East London was like in those days, and even surprised me, because I didn't think it was as bad as that. It reflects an earlier period of time, but in fact it doesn't. It reflects the late 40s and early 50s, just post-war. So, you know, that's how I was brought up. In very, very difficult times. But my parents both worked, so money wasn't sort of too tight in the house. So I had good food, and I had good clothes, good shoes, new shoes. Many kids at my age at that time in that area didn't have new shoes. Sometimes second-hand shoes, but I sort of did quite well, I suppose, in that way. The relationship I had with my parents as I grew up was okay. They never sort of expressed love. They never said, I love you, neither parent. I never remember that. They sort of weren't very supportive toward my education. But then I suppose with my dad not being able to read or write, that would have been a bit difficult for them, I guess. So that was sort of that's how my early years started out.
Wow. So, well, I'm glad you explained that because I was trying to figure out the hyphenated last name. So.
You're right.
Yeah.
I mean, my name is James Williamson, but I put that in to connect my name with my past, really, because I was a tailor. So it made that sort of connection.
Yeah. Where can people find your book?
The book is on Amazon. It was launched on the 8th of April. It's in both printed format and also as an e-book. So if people wish, they could buy it and put it on their Kindle or whatever the reading apparatus is that they have, or you can just buy the book, the printed version, which people still like to have. They like to hold a book, you know, still, thank goodness. So, you know, that's how it's, you can get your hands on a copy. And it sort of, it depicts my, as I said, my childhood, how I was adopted, how life was in those days. I mean, for example, we didn't have a bathroom. As I explained, we only had an outside toilet. We didn't even have hot water. So when I was a kid, baths were taken in a tin bath in front of the fire, or I'd be sat on the draining board and washed in a bowl of water. And as I grew older, I used to go to the public baths, the council baths, and you know, walk up to the nearby Market Street where the council baths were, and pay my money, and you know, you have a bath. So you know, it wasn't an easy beginning, not really, but it wasn't sort of as a child you don't see things like that. You know, I had my friends in the street and we'd play and things. Things were okay. It's only when you get older and you can get an idea of values and life changes, you know, as you get older. It certainly did in London. There was, you know, we were coming out of World War II and things were getting a little better, so, albeit slowly. So you could look back and you could think, gosh, you know, we didn't even have a refrigerator until I was 11. My mother didn't have a washing machine until 1976, when she was 51 years old, I think. Incredible. It was tough on a lot of people. What else can I tell you? Sorry?
I was going to say, when did the abuse start?
Well, at home, my father could get very aggressive and sometimes violent as I got older. I think as I could develop a sense of reason and I could read and write, maybe... As again, on reflection, I didn't see this at the time, but looking back, I think possibly he may have felt a bit intimidated by this young upstart that can suddenly read or write and so on. So he could get a bit awkward with me and violent sometimes. I'd seen some pretty tough rows between him and my mother and so on, so that wasn't easy. And then one day when I was about 9.5 years old, I said I there was a movie at the cinema. Could I go and see it in the evening? And I was, yeah, you can go. And I was given the money, and I took myself off to the cinema. 9.5 years old, and I went to the cinema, and a man sat next to me, and. That's when the physical abuse first happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then the man followed me out of the cinema and, I don't know, like a sheep, I just followed him. And then I was sexually abused by him. And when that happened, I sort of remember I was really quite confused, and I thought I'd done something wrong. I thought it was my fault, and I decided that I couldn't possibly tell my parents because it was my fault, and also I feared that if they knew, they might think that I was, you know, that they'd adopted a reject, and that I could end up being put in a home, a children's home. So if I didn't say anything, then they couldn't think that way. So I kept the secret on that.
Mm.
So that was
so
the
as,
first time.
Mm-hmm. James, you know, as a child, you said your father abused you. You know, as a young child, how did you cope with that?
Well, when I say abuse, let's just clarify that point. It was verbal and physical as far as violence at times was concerned. It wasn't sexual abuse. So I have to be honest. I'm very honest. So, you know, there's no point in trying to fool anybody. How did I cope with it? Well, when you're in that situation, when children are in that situation, what can you do? If you're 8 years old or 10 years old, you can't run away. You just have to sort of... I tried to keep out of his way. Tried to recognize the symptoms of when one of his explosive moods was coming on. As I said, my mother and father worked. And my mother would sometimes come home and she'd cook dinner. And she'd put his dinner in front of him. And then he'd just push it away and say, I don't want that. Now, he used to swear, I won't quote him, but he used to swear a lot. So there was a lot of bad language. And when that happened, you just freeze because you think, this is it. There's trouble coming. What's going to happen? So you deal with it. You try and keep out of the way. You can't avoid it. You try to keep out of the way. You can't avoid it by getting out of the house or leaving home. You're too young. But so... it was just a question of trying to put up with it, really, and trying to keep out of the way. And the older I got, the easier it was to get out of the way, because, you know, you got a boy, you've got a bicycle, you go out with your mates, and then once I was even a little bit older, I actually got a motorbike when I was 16, and, you know, I could keep out of the way in the house, which became a little easier. But when you're younger, you can't do that. You just have to put up with it. Kids put up with stuff, and it's hideous.
Now, after the abuse in the movie theater, James, you know, you weren't able to go back to your mother and father and explain to them what had gone on because you had shared earlier it wasn't something you wanted to share. Did you have anybody that you could share with, or did you just basically internalize it?
No, I didn't share it with anybody. And then about a year later, maybe less, I joined the Scouts. And, you know, I joined early. You're supposed to join at 11, and I joined at about 10 and a half. I sort of lied about my age so I could get in because, you know, it seems like a good thing to do. I desperately wanted to do it. So I joined the Scouts. They didn't question age too much. Boys from Bow didn't have, not too many of them had uniforms because I couldn't afford them. And it was sort of a two nights a week, Tuesday and Thursday. It was like a social evening, and it was fun. And then my scoutmaster, after some months, not many months, had been offered a new job and during the daytime and so on, so he had to move away. So we were given a new scoutmaster who joined. And after a few more months, there was an occasion, and the book explains this probably in greater detail than I'm doing now, but Tom, his name was, showed interest in me, showed kindness to me, and listened to me talking and saying, you know, I have trouble with my dad and so on. And he saw an opportunity, and I was offered what I now call conditional kindness. he threw me a barbed lifeline. And when I grabbed hold of it, I was hooked. And he offered me a place of sanctuary. His apartment, he too lived in the upstairs of the house. And his apartment was a place I could go where it was quiet, I could listen to music, and I didn't feel threatened. So it was my place of sanctuary. And for that, A, he took advantage of that. And again, I never said anything. I couldn't. And that's how that went on for a few years.
You know, James, before I turn this over to Mike, I just want to ask you one last question about, you know, going back to the abuse that happened after the movie. You know, because you couldn't talk to anybody and you had to internalize it, as a young child, how did you cope with what had happened?
I'll be honest with you, I just buried it away. I just buried it away. It didn't happen. That's how I coped. I didn't tell anybody, and it didn't happen. I didn't think about it. I didn't think about the person that had done this. I just buried it away. Nobody knew until I eventually wrote the manuscript.
Wow. All right, let me go ahead and just take a break.
I showed that to my partner, who was the first person to see or to know.
Wow. So in a way, in hindsight, the manuscript was almost like a healing process.
Yeah, it was a strange experience, to be honest with you. It was very strange. It was all right until I'd given it, I'd handed it out to, first of all, as I said, to my partner. I was okay until I did that. But then when I did that, that is when somebody else knew. Until that moment, all it was my words on paper, and still only I knew about it. But as soon as I handed that out, then I'd shared my secret. And I was always sort of brought up to believe that a secret shared isn't a secret. So, you know, once you do that, I laid myself, after some thought, I might add, I laid myself open. I laid myself open to, if the book did well, to people asking me questions, to be able to talk about it. I had people saying to me when they did read the manuscript, "Do you realize that this is going to change your life? What's been a secret for you for all these years, you're going to be talking about it. Are you ready for that?" Well, I felt that I was, or that I am. Those days of guilt have gone, and I know that those things weren't my fault. If anything, the only thing I did wrong was not telling anybody. But I had my reasons, as I explained, for that. And I don't regret that. And my only hope, really, is that now, for people that read that book, will have a better understanding of how these things can happen to their children, and how people, parents, give away a terribly valuable thing far too easy, and that thing is called trust. They allow people into their lives and become too trusting, too easy. And I feel that that my parents trusted Tom too easy. But they didn't.
Let's take a quick break, and then we'll turn it over to Mike for some questions. For people who are tuning in, you're listening to the Men's Spiritual Radio Hour on Spiritual Connections Radio. You can find out more about this show and other shows, and links to our guests are on the website at www.spiritualconnectionsradio.com. And the Men's Show is generally on the second or third Tuesday of every month. But as we had mentioned earlier in the show, from time to time, we do run special shows when we want to get guests on right away, which was the case with our guest today. And with that, Mike, go ahead.
So I just had a couple questions. The first one is, well, first of all, how long ago did you write the book that we're talking about tonight?
I started to write the manuscript in about 2002. That's when I started.
Oh, okay.
So it's some time ago that I started to write the story. And, you know, you leave it, you go back, and you deal with difficult bits, and you leave it, and you go back and so on.
Oh, okay. Because my question was going to be then, so by the time you had reached that point in your life where you started to write the book, was that the first time that you opened up about it to anybody? Like, had you ever had the opportunity to talk to anybody up until that point? Or was your way of sharing it by just writing the book?
I'd had the opportunity to share it, obviously, because of my new people in my life that I could trust to talk to. But I didn't want to. It had been a secret for so long. If you keep a secret for long enough, it almost becomes part of, I always think it becomes like part of your fiber. It's part of your body, part of your life. And you're so used to keeping that secret, you just, divulging it is not easy. So I never felt that I could have just sat down with anybody and said, oh, you know, by the way, you know, let's talk about my past, let's talk about this. I couldn't do that. I just couldn't do it. But then when I started to write, I wanted to write a book. I had always wanted to write. And I couldn't really find a subject that I could easily write about, and I couldn't think of what I was going to write about. And suddenly I thought, well, hang on a moment, I've had an interesting life. Why don't I just write that down? And of course, with an autobiography, one memory triggers another. You don't have to sort of make things up, it's all true. And so that's what prompted me to start to write, obviously, to write the book. And it takes a long time to find an agent and then to find a publisher and so on. So it's easy for lots of time to pass. And plus the fact that, you know, life was moving on for me. My business was, you know, good and so on. So, you know, I had to wait. Writing, what I always used to think, is about time and timing. You know, I had the time and it was the right timing to do it. I was in the right frame of mind to write that book, write that manuscript.
So my next question would be, it's actually a two-part question. When once the book was released, and you would have started getting feedback from different people that read it, did you start to feel any weight off your shoulders, that you felt like you were doing some more healing? And if so, has it expanded as you've gotten older, like to this day? Do you feel that you heal a little bit more each day as a result of you taking that leap of faith to share this? And like you said, your intention was that hopefully you can help others with it. So have mm-hmm. you felt any kind of release or weight off your shoulders? Not just weight as far as like letting go of the secret and maybe instilling some maybe releasing some fear in yourself, but also, I guess I would say, just a sense of accomplishment in a way that you want to try to help others so this could maybe prevent other people from having to go through that. Have all those things hit you since you released the book?
Well, yeah. I mean, I found the book cathartic. So, you know, to write the story, you be sort of, yes, okay, you're freeing up memory space, if you like, you know, stuff that's been locked away. And the more you discuss it, the more you read it, the better one feels. But the book, I'd like to sort of say, I mean, I do remember reading I've read several books, you know, you read books about this sort of thing to give you an idea of the way they work. And I've read one or two books that have been just endless abuse, page after page. It's just been awful. And I didn't want my book to be like that, because there's light and shade in my life. And whilst my father could be what he was at times, he wasn't like that every single day of the week. And there was moments of generosity and so on. So I tried to sort of make everybody seem not all bad. And my life wasn't all bad. It was sometimes bad, and often there was a lot of wrong in it. So, you know, when I did finish writing this, I was sort of quite pleased that I'd actually managed to do that after so long. And then the more I thought about it, the more I thought that, yes, it actually could help somebody else. And there was a case I remember in the UK in a county called Lincolnshire, I think it was, where a young boy had been, he was probably about 14, I guess, blonde, and popping in, he lived in the village, and he would pop into this shop on his way home from school and maybe buy some sweets or whatever. And the man in the shop befriended this boy and ended up killing him. And they caught the guy. And I thought, gosh, I wonder if that boy would have, if he'd have read my book, maybe he was a young, about-to-be gay man. And not understanding his situation. And maybe his parents, if they'd have read the book or the boy had read the book, it might not have made any difference, but it might have made some difference. And that's what I started to think. I wonder if this could help somebody else. I certainly didn't start to write it with that in mind. And initially, I didn't even start to write it to be a book. I just wrote a story. And it sort of grew into that, really. I'm sorry, I hope I've answered that.
What's that?
I hope I've answered that.
Oh yeah, definitely. And you know, I bet the interesting part about this too is you probably have helped many people who've read the book in different ways, because many of us have all personally probably have come across somebody that we've met in our life at one time or another that's dealt with this, and especially into the generations when you grew up, you know, it was definitely a lot. You just didn't speak about it exactly like the way you said, where today there's so much more help available. There's so much more programs to turn to. I mean, not that even today there's plenty of people that probably are afraid to speak up as well. But I mean, I can definitely imagine, like you said, back in your generation that it was just, you know, nobody wanted to hear it, or they wouldn't believe you. I can totally understand that. But, you know, for you to have the courage to write the book, and then the people that read it, you know, I'm sure there's plenty of people that have read it that have gone through similar situations. And, you know, I just know that it just, on a healing level, it really helps others to identify with other people that went through the same thing. So, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing, because, like you said, you know, you might never hear from many people that read the book, because they may still not be comfortable in openly sharing, but something inside of them may have changed just by, you could have maybe prevented other murders in a way. You know what I mean? You'll never know.
Well, that's right. Now, I've met an awful lot of people that have said to me that they've been through, not necessarily a similar experience, but an experience, a form of abuse and so on. So there's an awful lot of it out there. The difference when I was a child to today is awareness, and people are a lot more aware of things going on today because of television, because of things like rolling news programs, Sky News, CNN or whatever, where if something happens, within a couple of minutes, you're watching it on television in your home. Whereas when I was a child, firstly, we didn't have a television until I was 10. And secondly, news in the main, people were interested in their own area. So our local newspaper provided the news that people were happy with. It didn't provide them with national news, just local news. Some people couldn't afford to buy a daily paper. So, you know, just people were ignorant of what was going on. And that is absolute food for a paedophile. Ignorance is bliss for somebody like that. And that's how they get away with it. But
yeah,
the more aware we are, the less easy it is for these people that do this to these to children.
And I think what's even more fascinating about the times we live in today is that, you know, there's so much coming out, especially in some of the different religious organizations where, you know, little children would put their trust in you know, maybe their priest or somebody like that they thought they would feel the most comfortable with. And the thing of it is stuff that happened 40, 50 years ago, and individuals that were responsible that are still living are being held accountable. And, you know, people might say, well, because it happened so long ago, how can you still charge them? Well, you don't know in that 40, 50-year time span how many different people they may have abused in that time period and people that didn't speak up about it. So, you know, there's just so much coming out that I think us as a society in general in the world today is putting our foot down. And for the first time in a long time, I think people are willing to listen more than ever before. So it's an incredible journey, I think. And I think, you know, your book is hand-in-hand with what's going on today and just saying no to this kind of stuff and making people aware. And so I think you've done a great service by sharing and making people aware.
Well, you know, it's always going to be in the news. It's always going to be happening. That's never going to change. One can only hope it would be to a lesser extent because of awareness. And as I said, you know, trust is easily given. I mean, my scoutmaster, the scout troop, and thanks to him, we bought a van, an old van, that would take the kit of the us boys to the campsite to save us all carrying this kit. And, of course, my scoutmaster couldn't drive, so he asked my dad if he would drive the van and became sort of a friend of the family. And therefore, when I was invited to stay over one night because I'd been asked to go to this meeting organizing the summer camp and so on. And afterwards it was suggested that, you know, we could go to the pictures and it wouldn't be safe for me to go home. Why not stay over? My parents said yes. And that really was the start of it all, really. It's all about trust. I think people have got to be aware.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. Mark.
Yeah. I actually missed part of that, so I apologize if I ask the same question again. But, James, can you talk about finding peace and also within that same topic, talk about forgiveness? What is forgiveness for you?
Well, funny you should say that. I found when I wrote the book, it seemed like I found peace, and I'm a happy guy, you know. So I enjoy my life, which is good. Forgiveness. I struggled to forgive my father quite a few years after he died. He's been dead, 20 years this year, I think. And I sort of forgave him. Four or five years ago, I suppose. And I just let that one go. I think people spend too much time worrying about the past and how the past affects them. And what they do is they let the past affect the future. And I sort of always thought that I'm never going to get let my yesterday ruin my tomorrows. And I think that if you're bitter or you carry hatred, that's what happens. So, you know, you need to let that go.
Yeah, you had said accepting yourself. You were talking about the fact that you originally, the first time you got married, that you married a woman and eventually came to terms with your sexuality. Can you talk about that?
Well, that's not actually covered in this book. There is a sequel to that. There's a second book that deals with how I got my life sorted out. Really, I got into a terrible muddle. I was young. I got into a terrible muddle. So it's how I dealt with that muddle and formed a proper life for myself. But yes, I got married. The book actually starts on my wedding morning. And I got married. And it took me a long time to come to terms with what I wanted in life and to be able to achieve that. And have that. And the biggest problem I had is that me having what I felt I needed came at a cost to others, i.e., especially my wife at that time. But I just couldn't continue living life as I was. It just got to the point where it had to change. And at one stage, and I'll be completely honest with you, I mean, suicide was an option. I just thought about that on a couple of occasions. And but I got through that phase, thank goodness, and changed my life.
Wow. So what is the name of the next book, and when is it coming out?
The second book will be called, at this moment in time, Who's Afraid of Tomorrow? And I'm not quite sure when that will come out. I think we need to give, it'll probably be a year. I think we need to give They Can't Touch Him Now a good opportunity for people to obtain, read, and understand. Various people that obviously already read it are enjoying it because of the way it describes the era. So lots of people of my age, or say 50s or whatever, can sort of relate to it, especially English people that lived through those times. But even in America, things were different in those days, and there'll be lots of connections, I'm sure. And of course, you know, it explains how London was in those days. And people are always interested in that, I feel.
I know it's it might not be something you're aware of. It's probably not too important as far as the statistic, but you know, because of the work that you've done on the book, do you happen to know, like, out of every 10 children, how many of them are abused?
No, I don't. I don't know. As I said, I've had conversations with many people that have said that they were abused, but I don't have that sort of information. I would imagine it's probably a little higher than people would think. But I don't have the figures.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead, Mike. Mike, are you there?
Are you there?
Okay. There you go.
Yeah. I said I was looking on your website, so there's also a third book you're working on as well?
No, that's what, do you remember I said to you that the website's under construction, it needs to be updated. All I've done is the third book I felt would be sort of perhaps pushing my story too far as a third book. So I've combined it and edited the two books into one. So there will only be a second book, but all of the time period of my life will be covered in that second book. And I just wanted the point of the first book was to explain the story of the past. The second book was the point of the second book was to explain how I got in the mess, out of the mess that I got myself into. And the third book really was to explain how I'd done as an individual, how successful I'd been as an individual, given the very poor start that I'd had. So it's combined, so people still can get to find that out by just in the second book. So, you know, I hope that sort of answered that, really. I mean, considering that I left school at 15 with no qualifications whatsoever, I think I left with a 100-yard swimming certificate, and that was it. So I've done quite well, really.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, too. I can imagine the gratitude you must have just for, you know, after hearing your childhood, the gratitude you must have just for modern conveniences, like, you know, just having indoor plumbing and a washing machine and stuff like that, you know, it's amazing how far you've come with that, too, just that...
And nice cars and houses and things like that, all hard work, I have to say. But you're right, and I think that we all, society today, takes pretty much everything for granted. As I explained, it wasn't, I mean, I find that we, in the UK, the credit card is a big thing. And I rather feel that we live in a must-have society. I must have that. I must have the latest iPhone or whatever. And so we have a lot of debt in the UK on credit cards. And why didn't we have that? Well, we didn't have anything in the window shop windows to buy. You know, there was none of those inventions. A refrigerator was beyond the reach of financially of a lot of people. So, you know, we just got on with what we had. But today... people have so much, you know. So I think that's the difference. But I certainly appreciate the fact that, you know, I have a nice car and a nice home and so on. And so I don't sort of go around just taking things for granted. I know what it's like not to have. That's for sure.
Yeah, and I think it's good too for your readers to see that too, because we you know, most of us that, you know, we're born in the past, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, you know, we've just had those conveniences, and, you know, to listen to what, you know, people of your generation had to go through in that location at that time, you know, it's important for us to all, you know, because I know the closest we've come in my area, you know, is when we've had some really bad storms or hurricanes, and you might have a week with no electricity or something like that, you know, but to have that kind of conditions, and it's just because that's how life is, you know, it's good for people to know that, you know, this is what happened, you know, and maybe be a little more appreciative of when you hit a light switch, the light comes on and you have water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah, so. That's right, fresh water out of the tap, and so on. So yeah, I think we all should be a bit thankful now and then, when you see what goes on in places like we've just seen in Nepal, the earthquakes and so on. Aren't we lucky?
Yes. Yes.
For what we have, aren't we lucky? But there you go.
Okay, Mark, you got
it. All right. So, James, we always like to ask our guests towards the end of the show, what is the biggest life lesson you have for this lifetime?
Well, I suppose As we get older, we experience, I recently lost, just a few weeks ago, buried a cousin, and he was 57, diagnosed with cancer of the spine, hip, shoulder, lung, and they gave him 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and he died in three. I think things like that make me appreciate life, because as you get older, you become a little bit more aware of how vulnerable we are. Because as you get older, you know, people around you start to die because we're getting older. You don't experience that when you're so much in your teens. Although I do cover one chapter in my book of my first great loss, it's called, and so it deals with that. So I think loss, I think appreciation of people, of kindness, and of love. I appreciate that. I appreciate that, and I never understand. I can't understand why there's so much sort of awfulness in the world. So I appreciate peace, and the things that I have, and I try to be a decent person. You know, I'm not aggressive. I'm not hateful. I just try to be a good person and appreciate the things that I've worked for and have.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you for such a great interview, for sharing your story to help so many, and for being on the show and everything. Why don't we go ahead and go through a couple informational pieces before we close out the show. Why don't you go ahead and give out your website to everybody?
Well, the website is jameswilliamsontaylor.com, and the book is called They Can't Touch Him Now. It's titled that because the protagonist in the book is dead, so that, hence the title. And it's available on Amazon.com or Amazon.co.uk. It's available in printed format, and it's available as an e-book. And I hope some of your listeners obtain the book and share their thoughts with me. My email address is printed inside the front cover of the book. Anybody wants to contact me, feel free to do. And I'm always happy to, if not to advise, but certainly to listen.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Mike, for a great show. And I'll go ahead and just close out and just say, everybody, you've been listening to the Men's Spiritual Radio Hour on Spiritual Connections Radio. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.